So let me address a few things that were mentioned in the last few talks, mainly yesterday and the day before and today. Do we understand gallium manganese arsenide? Mainly addressing the bulk of this talk is going to be addressing some questions that Hideo mentioned the other day, which is, do we have an intrinsic limit, or do we see an intrinsic limit in the TC, in gallium manganese arsenide, which is our bestly, and also whether we do have an understanding of this system. So some of the reference, of course, of us here, together with the bulk of the talk as well, that's going to be based on this review of modern physics that we've written up, and the funding to the agencies as well. So the team, let me introduce the team. So some of you may think of this as conflict things, and so we need to be prepared to be tough. So one of the members of the team is Alan McDonald, who has a history of being tough. You know, this guy, ancestor, I assume, is of his, from Nova Scotia, which is, of course, one I found it on the web. So hopefully this one of his relatives, I'm sure. There's a lot of McDonald's in Nova Scotia. You know, ours has an H in it. So this, you know, the distance relative has an H. So it doesn't look as tough, right? You know, it became a little nicer. Then Thomas Jangworth is the other one. He's looking very smart in his only time I've ever seen him with a tie. Myself, but also with many, many collaborators as well that we've learned many physics from, okay? And I think I'm missing many names here, so I apologize to all of them. We almost look like a high-energy collaboration many times, of 15 authors or more, but my philosophy is the more the merrier, the more you have a chance to learn about things. So just an outline of the talk. First, let me just introduce, and this has been also introduced as well earlier, but just to keep in the same face, some of the phenomenology in the diluted magnetic semiconductors, some possible stumbling blocks to high TC that were believed to be present or still thought to be present in many people's minds, and the theoretical approaches that are used to try to understand these diluted magnetic semiconductors, you know. Something versus something, or should it be all together? That's the question. And what is the theory telling us about high TC, TC. Is there an intrinsic limit from the theory that we see? Is there an extrinsic limitation? And then the data itself, which is now we actually, from spintronics, I think gallium manganese arsenide, GAMNAS, is one of the best understood systems, or at least certainly the one that we have the most data of. So we have to now come back very carefully and say, okay, what we believe we understand and compare to experimental all the time, okay? Because physics is an experimental science. We theories are just simply decoration. So what is the data telling us? And then, just to address a little bit what coming to Dimitri's talk yesterday, what are the successes that, you know, why do we think that we do understand a little bit of what's going on? So some of these I'll brush, you know, I will not go very much into detail, because each of them can be a talk on themselves, but just highlighting the agreements and comparison to experiment. This actual review that we did was trying to see the different approaches, not just the phenomenological approaches to experiment, and some of the remaining challenges that we have, quite a few of them actually. But So in the late 2002, after, you know, Hideo's groundbreaking work, at some point, you know, all of a sudden we have, you know, 50 Kelvin, and poof, you know, in 96, very large jump there of temperatures, TCs, you know, very promising. But for a long time, you know, nothing happened. You know, it's 110. Everybody was worried, well, is that the ceiling? You know, is this, is only metallic in a window of manganese concentration that it was observed? There was a high degree of compensation in the samples, lots of extra dirt, and very unusual magnetization temperature that many models tried to reproduce, which of course now they shouldn't have, but they tried to reproduce as an intrinsic thing of the system, okay, which, you know, turned out not to be, of course. But then again, you know, this ceiling, it was a problem. You know, is there any, you know, is there a ceiling to this? You know, is there any hope?
is any part of the intrinsic contribution. So let's try to understand first just what happens in gallium manganese arsenide. As you know, you've seen this many times. I think I'm probably going to skip it. You introduce the manganese as a, you know, D levels and all that. It introduces as an acceptor, a moderately shallow acceptor, as they told you in the previous talk. And this D level of electrons come localized mostly as a 5-half type of electrons. Now, the physics of the coupling between the holes in this case and the localized manganese electrons, the electrons, is fairly simple to see in this picture. Okay, this is more or less what some of the physics that were mentioned in the previous talk. You introduce the manganese that has these D levels deep in the valence band and in the conduction band, a split between them, and they tend to repel, you know, this D minus, if they're polarized in this direction, they're going to hybridize with this guy, this level of repulsion, and essentially hybridization through hybridization, this kinetic exchange coupling, the S. However, there's also, we're aware of another type of mechanism that is not so nice, which is the antiferromagnetic double exchange coupling between the D electrons when the manganese get too close. So you are going to have a competition between those two effects, and similar like manganese arsenide is antiferromagnetic itself. Now the question, of course, is, you know, once you have this picture in your head, how to actually approach it and what is the description? You know, what is, you know, is the controversy? Lots of controversy, you see. And this is one of those things that that people like to show in in fights. There's going to be fights, right? So hi, Nunat. So you think of this Imperial Bandit versus Valence Joe, okay? Or you can think of Fast Principle Jack versus K.P. Eastwood or something like that. But the message, you know, there's a lot of talk that, you know, influence. Okay, this versus that, this versus this picture. The message today, I hope you get, is that there's no silver bullet, okay? There's the bullet that's here, that of K.P. Eastwood, but not, it's not, doesn't belong to either of them. It has to be really a combination of all the theories that have to give in this mosaic of a theory that has to be agreeing, okay? It's okay, that's enough of theatrics. So what are the theoretical approaches to DMSs? So let's go through the three major ones and try to understand, you know, some of them do something better than others, and some of them are valid in one region, and some of them give you some systematic account of other effects. But you also have to be aware of the pros and the cons of each of the systems, okay? The first principle, you know, first principles Jack, or fast principles as the previous slide showed, the pros, there's no initial assumptions. You just simply, you know, put everything in a lattice and let it run. It can give you an effective Heisenberg model, can be extracted from it. And it's good for determining chemical trends. Okay. Essentially, if you want to find out, you know, say you get a TC in this modeling, and you want to find out what other, you know, compound would give you a higher TC. Well, in that sense, it's probably not a bad idea, because even if it doesn't estimate TC correctly to a factor of 2 or 3, the trends, you have a hope that it will. You know, one of the limitations of this approach, of course, is the side limitations of the computations. They're large, computationally expensive. They have usually typically done in this for only a particular magnetization doping, right? A couple of doping systems in this supercell structures that they calculate. So you cannot do a continuum doping. That itself also puts you another challenge, because in some regimes, you know, at the regimes that where the experiments are being done, the manganese-manganese interactions are longer in range than the typical supercell size that you can get. So, you know, you can get stuck pretty fast in obtaining the correct physics. And the quantitative, the lack of quantitative predictability, I'm sure many people would shoo me off for this. But the problem is that, you know, in this case, this is well understood. For example, the exchange coupling tends to be overestimated many times, because these D levels that I showed you the picture of earlier, they tend to be a little closer to the valence band
than they truly are, just from optics, from the spectra that we know about. That way, this hybridization tends to be much stronger than it really is, essentially overestimating their effect. And it neglects things like spin orbit coupling, so many of the things that are seen in experiment cannot be computed in terms of... Yeah?
I was just going to comment that you're being rather kind about that, because when you say no initial assumptions,
you
have to actually get it to work with first principles. You put in the assumption, so it becomes an empirical model.
It is an empirical model, but it's not biased towards, you know, what type of low energy excitations do you have, for example. You're not making that ahead of time, right? I mean, you just have this. You take your best guess. I'm sorry.
Move the D levels around until you get something.
Okay. Yeah, that you do. Yeah. Yeah, that's significant. That I agree. Well, it's trying to be nice, you know. But actually, one thing that is done too. That is okay. But it also captures several things. For example, this double exchange mechanism. You know, it treats them both equally. Then, you know, the minute that we go to this phenomenology, as I'm going to mention later in the K.P model, this physics of the antiferromagnetic coupling is gone, whereas here it's still present. Right? So that itself, it allows you to capture that. Actually, also the Tibetan CPA calculations do that as well. And the nice thing that we found out so far, I'm not sure you're probably not aware that we do actually these calculations too in the Czech Republic. We do quite a few of those. That they match rather well, LDA plus U, okay? Because they have not only LSDA, but they have LDA plus U. They have also SICK SDL, and SICK doesn't mean that it's complicated. It just simply means self-interaction corrected. But anyway, that's that. I'll say more about that in a second. And then we go to the microscopic tight binding models. Now, those are a bit of an in-between the two. One of the things that they do in these models is that they get fairly well the electronic structure. Okay, you can obtain it from this tabulated hopping that you can look up in the old literature. It's still unbiased in the sense, again, not totally unbiased, it's still semi-phenomenological, but it can treat disorder more microscopically. The effects of this, Michael mentioned earlier, and Tang mentioned earlier, the nice effects of what the single individual impurity is going to do for you, etc., is very good very good agreement with LDA plus U. So those two are fairly complementary. So, and this one is less computationally expensive than the, and less of a black box in a sense, I would say, to my opinion, but that's only my opinion. Density functional, but then also things like the hybridization, it is correctly. It also helps you, and as I'm going to show you, to tell you about the impurity concentrations. By looking at the different energetics of introducing an impurity in the system, because it's important, and that will be important in terms of determining whether TC can be reached or not. Is there a limit? Is there an intrinsic limit to being able to stuff more and more substitutional manganese in or not? Okay, that's an important question. And for example, in the doping in here, one you can do, you can dope it with codopants, things like that. That's one thing. So you actually have a lot more flexibility in terms of manipulating the doping than in the picture above. Yeah?
Just comment about the neglecting cooling reaction.
You can put them in here, but I'm saying electron-electron interaction is still a single particle theory. In that case, you don't put them in some sort of exchange correlation potential, the exchange correlation potential, for example, right?
No.
That's
no.
Okay.
You can put
Hartree-Fock. Okay. Yeah. So you can do Hartree-Fock. So that typically is not done in most calculations. I'm just saying here the typical, because usually this usually is never done, but it can be done actually. We have a guy in the Czech Republic that does from the LDA from the Dirac equation directly. It's very impressive. Right, so it's all there.
It's all electron. All electron. It's, you don't have soft super potentials.
I don't know the details of that. but it's very impressive as far as I know. Anyway, so and then again, hard to reach large system sizes, but it can give you lots of nice features. And also it tells you, that, for example, this whole thing of that we were talking about of JPD dependence on energy and on the location and in the Fermi C that you have, that will be there. Okay, that is oversimplified. Now the K.P plus local moment, of course, is the very spherical. I mean, I'm from Texas, so I'm allowed to talk about cows. Is the spherical cow here? Okay, it's certainly the simplest model. The simplicity of the description is one of its beauties. Lots of computational ability, as you're going to see, just because this is just normal Fermi liquid type of thing. You can do lots of calculations and compare it continuously to experiment to see, okay, does this spherical cow make any sense? And you can incorporate very easily the spin orbit coupling. Actually, I should say that here you can also incorporate the spin orbit coupling rather easily as well. So that's the two advantages. So it's kind of like a bridge in between. And it's applicable, but at the same time, this recognizes the fact that the length scales here of the manganese-manganese interactions and all these compensated states are still large enough that an envelope function type of approach, which is this, can be used. Okay, it wouldn't work the minute that you have these manganese-manganese interactions short range. So then that's completely gone, which happens, for example, in these deep impurity levels. Okay, so it only works for a shallow acceptor level, which is gallium manganese arsenide can be considered one. And of course, one of the drawbacks is the oversimplicity, the fact that you're trying to describe this very complex behavior by single parameter, the band structure of the host material and a single parameter JPD, independent of energy. Okay, the fact that you actually even will agree with anything is pretty amazing. Okay, so what is this? My emphasis is not that either of them is best than the others. I've used this a long time, but we're using this continuously to check on this as well, whether they make sense, because this will capture some physics that this doesn't, and this one will capture some physics that doesn't. Okay.
So when you say time, that doesn't. Hard to reach large system sizes, you're comparing these.
So with this order averaging, for example, you still have to do a supercell type of calculation type of thing, right?
You do CPA in the
K-DOT,
you can do CPA in
here. Yes, CPA in here, right? Microscopic type banding model there.
No, I'm not. You have limitation when you're trying to do average in real space. So you can also do average in real space.
Yeah, that's the CPA part, right? So that's okay. That's one thing that we do, that you can do that. But here, you're not so limited by system sizes from the fact that you can do much larger system sizes than these guys, of course, right? No doubt. Right? But my understanding was, and this, I'm not an expert on this calculation, so you are. Okay. But I think the supercell calculations are a little more difficult. Karsten Tim, who will be here, actually he's sneaking in. And June, I think, coming by, does those type of calculations, and he tells me that he's very limited to similar, not similar, much more than this, of course, but rather limited by that.
It really depends on what approach you use.
Okay.
If you put your FMI model on lattice and solve the wave functions, then you do have a lot of finite size effects. That
right.
If you use a Green's function, you don't have that issue.
Okay, it depends probably also on the physics that you're trying to approach, right? I mean.
No.
So you think the Green's function is just simply because you just focus on the low and the length, low and left scales that way?
You're not focusing on long scales. That's not the issue. You're focusing on a disordered system that's embedded in an open clean system.
Yes.
It's having essentially a periodic
exactly.
system.
Exactly. Which is what this is all the time.
Yeah.
No matter what you do.
Having your disorder embedded within an open region is much better prepared from a computational point of view because you don't have.
Right, then you can calculate the outside completely, and just the Lana breaker type of thing. But at the same time, if you want to model a large bulk random disorder system, is that still effective? Maybe.
I actually don't know how big a size you need to get to really do the bulk.
Yeah, that's the
better, in a sense, better than the kid
option. Right. Yeah. Yeah, certainly. Yeah, you should. This should approach that at some point. Anyway.
Can I make a remark? I mean, about Green's function, the embedding of, and it's very elegant, but if you want to look at the interaction between two manganese atoms a long way around, along.
By
large distance, you're going to have to integrate the inverted matrix, which is going to be comparable in size to the problem of the supercellular calculation.
It's minus the region where the potential is different from the average.
That's right. So if you're assuming there's those directions.
Now, the proper way to do this, formally, is that you self-consistently determine the background of what you're measuring. And then it can be rather fast.
Yeah, but you still have to solve your Dyson equation on a cluster including those two manganese atoms.
Don't have to include the sides in between.
Yeah, because those aren't perturbed.
But if there's an interaction, there must be
I don't agree that it will not affect.
The deviation from what the so-called homogeneous material does not occur in between.
Okay.
So it's based on the potential, not on the distortion of the wave functions.
Okay. This is a theme for next discussion. Right. I'll give him the microphone in a second.
The spatial resolution problem in k.p theory is not intrinsic to k.p theory, it depends on what k.p you use. If you're picking up bands, you can have arbitrary resolution.
Right. The point is, you don't want to be picking too many bands. You lose the advantage.
But people tend to use k.p theory when they want to solve a problem with a relatively small number of degrees of freedom.
Exactly.
They do first principles calculations when they have bigger computers and they're willing to have a larger number of degrees
That's
of
right.
freedom. But the real fundamental figure of merit is the number of degrees of freedom per atom or something like that. And so to compare an LSTA calculation with a huge number of degrees of freedom per atom with k.p theory with a very small number of degrees of freedom per atom and say, well, k.p theory is accurate, it's not comparing the same thing.
That's right. I mean, and this is what you want to obtain from here. I mean, this one, of course, is the lower degrees, energy degrees of freedom phenomenology. But you want to be checking that you're doing the right phenomenology from that. So, if you can, that's the point. And eventually, I mean, our goal as physicists, condensed matter physicists, is doing that. Take these enormous systems with very complicated systems and look for effective description in terms of the low energy degrees of freedom. Otherwise, there's no hope. You can just take the Schrödinger equation and solve it, but I don't find that a very advisable thing. So let me just go back now to all these theories. What is it telling us from the point of view of the TC, of this limit? Do we have a limit? Do we have any hope? Are we positive? Are we happy in entropy? Or should we just forget about it and write different proposals? So from the effect of the mean field, so this is actually a pretty heavy theory type of slide, so let me spend a little bit of time on this. Okay, the one on the left here contains almost all the information done within the k.p theory. Okay, the mean field theory, the initial one is this black line with this x proportional, the mean field proportional to x and p to the 1/3. Okay, this mean field contribution gets enhanced by the Hall-Hall exchange interactions, Stoner enhancement. Okay, that you can put in, and that typically enhances the TC. At the same time, the magnetic fluctuations, essentially spin density waves, the stiffness of the system is going to actually also reduce your TC. Okay? At higher and higher temperatures, you start creating more magnons in this magnetization. And you can do a calculation of the TC that way, and you obtain results where the collective manganese fluctuations, this one, this TC, is fairly flat. So you end up with essentially something that is with the mean field expectation at low doping, and then once you have more and more P, then it's fairly independent. Okay. Then you can go and do the macroscopic tie binding, but this one, this type of physics, for example, at this regime, although the TC, this is TC over X, by the way, that I'm plotting, In here, it's also going to be reduced by antiferromagnetic interactions, which this type of model does not capture. But this one, you can see some trends that you expect from that end. Essentially, the fact that for a low compensated sample, you expect TC to go down, you can see it here. This is plotting TC over X versus holes per manganese. Okay, and if you wonder how come you go beyond one, it's because you can co-dope it with other dopants, right, in these the calculations. And you see a expected reduction due to the antiferromagnetic exchange coupling. But then for a long range here, you actually have a fairly constant independent of doping. Okay, the TC is essentially linear in X, okay, for a long time. And then you expect at lower, so essentially this is summarized here, these two things put together, the fact that here is fairly independent of the hole concentration, and then it depends quite drastically on the hole concentration below a certain threshold, is telling you that below 50% compensation, you have a fast decrease of TC, and above 50% concentration, compensation of the samples, you expect essentially a linear behavior with X, okay? Not P to the 1/3, okay? That's one of the things that typically is missed from many talks that I hear, okay, in comparison to this thing, okay? So that's the expectation from the theory, what the theory put together, all these different theories tell us, okay? So that's the intrinsic expectation. Now the question is, can you do that? I mean, of course, these ones are only substitutional manganese that I put in here, for example. Keep that in mind, right? Now the extrinsic effects, we know that some beautiful experiments for Ferdina showed it a few years ago, that interstitials are the killers, okay? It was for a long time anticites, but now it's interstitials that we know are the ones responsible for the reduction of these systems and what the benefit of annealing is, essentially because these guys are compensating double donors, very bad, right? And not only that, these manganese tend to couple with the substitutional manganese and couple antiferromagnetically. And you can naively think that maybe once you couple to those two couple, they don't participate in the collective collective mode. Okay, so essentially the message is, okay, can we get rid of these guys? Is there an intrinsic limit to get rid of interstitials? Okay, beyond 10% doping of nominal doping, am I going to create more and more interstitial manganese or not? This is where the CPA calculations, where the tie binding CPA calculations and also LDA plus U that have been done in our group can help, because they can calculate those energy of formation of impurities. And here what you see, that's below 2% nominal, this is the nominal percentage of manganese, you only have substitutional. This is, the red is for substitutional, the blue is for interstitial. And beyond here, it just goes fairly linear of the two, and there doesn't seem to be any crossover. I mean, the worst thing would be that these guys cross. That would be the end of the day, okay? But they don't, okay? At least for fairly large percentages in here, okay? But this is theory. Let's test it, because we can test it. That's the whole point of now having this huge amount of data on manganese arsenide, gallium manganese arsenide, okay? Which is, now we can actually test it because of the fact that we know that most of the compensation is coming from interstitials. There's a little bit of antisites, but mostly interstitials. So taking this data, you have these ash-grown samples, and these the closed symbols are the anneal samples. I'm making the assumptions that that the manganese, assuming that the change in the hole density is due to the manganese out-diffusion of the system. You can then obtain in these samples, in these particular samples, the as-grown, these are as-grown percentages of interstitials to manganese, right? Essentially, by looking at these two, you can look at what was the ratio of the interstitial to substitutional here, Okay. And essentially now this is the test to compare, did your theory tell you whether you were right or wrong? I mean, here we've done the calculation of the Asgrom expectation, and the previous one, there's no fitting parameters of any kind, and it seems to be fairly good. Okay? As you can see in the trends of the analysis of the data, there is no indication that you can, you know, beyond this 10%, you can keep putting more and more substitutional manganese. As long as you get a hold of getting rid of these interstitials afterwards. So that's one thumbs up. Okay, an important thumbs up, because had it been the other way around, forget it. Okay? Then we can go to the question, well, what is the data telling us in terms of the expectation value of the TC? Is it following what we expect? Is it agreeing with the fact that, you know, beyond 50% compensation, you have fairly linear in X or not? And one of the key things that we wanted to address is how you plot things. It's a little, you have to be a little more careful, because now you have an idea of, typically, if you plot it as a function of total manganese concentration, nominal manganese concentration, and you stuff in the system to begin with, well, it doesn't look very encouraging sometimes, right? You know, you don't know if it's leveling off here, etc., and actually many plots can show you that it levels off, sometimes goes down. Okay, but the theory itself, the thing that you have to compare it is to the percentage of manganese substitutional, and also getting rid of the interstitial. Right? So you could actually compare, in theory, these guys as well, if you consider that interstitials in these systems are essentially killing off some of the other manganese, the substitutional manganese. And for that, you calculate in terms of, you plot it in terms of this effective manganese concentration, essentially the free substitutional in the system. Because now you've calculated, you've been able to obtain the ratio of the two, right? And here we plot both the, you know, the line, the expected line of being linear in X. Okay, these are for samples that are more than 50 per, you know, not very heavily compensated. These are heavily compensated, but these are not. Even the grown and as grown, the anneal and the as grown samples follow this linear in X behavior the minute that you do that. Yeah.
I'm a little bit confused. I think the statement made by this Nottingham group is that the best samples are not compensated.
Yes.
So your plot says that, I guess this, your 6% effective would correspond to, I don't know, 10%?
No, that one is compensated. No, but the best percent, the 6% or so is the one that is the 10%. Once you go beyond that, there are compensation, I believe. Okay, we can look that up in the data, but certainly those are the plots. I mean, that's the data. But there is some samples that if you look at the measurements, plus or minus 30%, because as I'm going to explain to you in a second, the from the whole measurements, the normal ordinary whole measurements, that gives you about a 20% error bar. Okay, that is typically in these multiband systems. Okay, but yeah. But they're, you know, once you get rid of all these guys, they seem to be uncompensated. Anyway, but yeah, they're all. I don't know how many of the samples are here, but we're getting more and more of them. And this is the idea of just, you know, samples are coming from everywhere. The Nottingham, the Czech Republic. And now we have also growing as well. And we want to start doing a systematic study of all of these samples all together to see what is extrinsic and what is intrinsic behavior. That's the our goal. So then, this is another here. I plot the same plot in here again. But now let me actually plot it versus this P and effective. Okay. Essentially, this was the expectation of, you know, beyond that flat and beyond that going down, and it seems to be following that fairly well. I mean, of course, I knew it was going to happen from this. Okay. But it seems to be following the trend that we expect from theory. So the key message, am I here? Okay. The key message of all this, of this analysis that we did with all these samples, trying to figure out how many interstitials and manganese substitutionals were there, that you have to look at this effective manganese substitutional, but that there is not an intrinsic challenge to from theory point of view, essentially, that somehow interstitials would be more prone to have beyond 10% or so, nor the data itself is showing you a limit, okay? Because if you look at, you know, you say, okay, at 10%, I would have to have a TC of, you know, room temperature. But if you look at this manganese effective concentration, only 6% has been achieved, even in the Nottingham data, I mean, the one that I showed you there. You know, the maximum number was 6%, okay? At least in the samples so far. So it seems to be that the charge compensation, that's important, unless it's 40%. 6.2 is the maximum achieved so far in this, you know, in the corresponds to 173K, that's the one in there for the Nottingham samples. You know, the challenge, of course, which is it can be a challenge that cannot be overcome, that I don't know, but it's a growth challenge, okay, not an intrinsic one, okay. So that was the main message, that it's not an intrinsic challenge to, from the theory, and also the theory compared to the data. But of course, we don't know if we just happen to be here, you know, gallium manganese arsenide happens to be in the perfect window. Here you have a very complicated phase diagram, okay, P versus N, where you have, you know, if you put too many P's, you're going to be in this frustrated RKKY interactions. If you know, if the doping is a little less, you're going to have this long interactions between the manganese, right? So you're not affected by these oscillations of the RKKY interactions. For larger exchange coupling, you're going to have this type of Kondo effect. So, you know, where is the optimal in between all these things? You just don't know. Maybe the challenge is to try to find a different material that would put you in the most optimal state in this phase diagram. So that's, you know, did we hit the jackpot with gallium manganese arsenide or not? That's the question as well. Okay. So then, you know, just to continue, so that was just TC, but I wanted to spend some time, and not very long, because I, you know, it's been too long a talk, so... Of what has been, you know, understood within these models, okay? So one thing that is important, and all of these properties that I'm going to just, I'm not going to spend very much time on this, they're just magnetic anisotropy, temperature dependence of the metallic samples, etc. They're all very independent. I mean, they're all very non-trivial, not independent, but non-trivial things to compare between theory and experiment, okay? One of the things is magnetic anisotropy. It's a very, the initial, very successful theory of Dietl. I don't have the reference, sorry about that. Anyway, the original is Dietl and also Abouffat did this as well, it's about the same time. Predicting in which direction is going to be the EC axis depending on the strain on the sample. Okay? That's highly non-trivial. That comes from this spherical Kalm model. Okay? Then you have... the temperature dependence of the metallic resistivity, and here, because this is a K.P model, we're always comparing, there's no physics that I'm addressing with this, by the way, of things that Michael and you would be addressing a little more, that has not been very much explored because the experiments have not been in that regime as much, which is the very low doping regime, the insulating regime, which could be fascinating. Okay, all of these things are addressing the more metallic one. These type of very highly annealed samples where you don't see these peaks, but you see a shoulder type of physics. Okay? And that has been rather nicely explained between by Lopez, Sanchez, and Bray, and Wang and Dasarma utilizing essentially Boltzmann transport. Okay? Then you go to another very non-trivial thing, which is the ferromagnetic resonance, the Gilbert damping coefficient. You can calculate in this PD model, okay, between the interaction between the holes and the localized, the localized holes and the localized the electrons, the actual damping from the Gilbert damping coefficient that appears in the Landau-Lifshitz Gilbert equations, okay, that explains the theory of ferromagnetic resonance. Okay, so this is the actual plot, and it can be compared to experiment, and the actual magnitudes, the numbers themselves, match rather well. Okay, not perfectly perfect, but rather well. It's a long paper, so I don't know. Oh, I have the reference here. Youngworth et al. Some year ago. Another one. So this is becoming a, what I'm trying to make the message is becoming a rather long list of things that are being matched rather well to experiment, things that are very different and very non-trivial. Anisotropic magnetic resistance, which in this case it was predicted, the experiment, there's luckily much more now. The slide that I used was a fairly old one, but it's well established. The trend as a function of a strain and the percentage number matches very well for the different dopants. Okay. Another one is another completely different piece of physics that appear in these diluted magnesium semiconductors, the new physics, which is tunneling anisotropic magnetoresistance. We're all used to this GMR, which is, this means, you know, high resistance state, low resistance state, that is in our laptops, expensive laptops. Okay, now we have what is equivalent to a magnetic switch, high resistance state, low resistance state, which is very, very unique to these systems. Okay? And again, some of the physics were explained using these phenomenological models, simple models. And lastly, and which is actually related to why, you know, I was supposed to talk about spin Hall effect, but this I have to thank for my travels and jumping into the spin Hall effect, understanding or believing that I understand, which of course I didn't completely at the time. I have a better feeling now of the anomalous Hall effect in this gallium manganese arsenide. When we first started this 6 years ago. We were looking at, okay, you know, the theory of the anomalous Hall effect as it is now, as some of it is in the spin Hall effect as well. It was a bit messy, side jump, skew, whatever. But we had a feeling of understanding some contributions, and we decided to take a more practical approach of saying, let me calculate that contribution and compare it to experiment, more of a phenomenological approach. So calculating this intrinsic contribution, as you may have heard now, of the anomalous Hall effect, there is some reason to believe that that would be dominant, and this intrinsic contribution is coming mainly from the difference in the Berry's phase in the orbital. Once you have the two guys, the time reversal broken, the time reversal symmetry of the system broken, and there was only one point initially, but now there's many more points of this minimal disorder theory, where you the effects of the disorder here, they're not these vertex corrections, which are a nightmare now, but which could be important actually and be contributions, so we need to continue working on this. But the initial assessment was that this was the experiments and the theory. Experiments are the open dots and the theory are the black dots. The plus and minus of the theory is not that my computer was, you know, giving me wrong numbers, it's just that there was not the knowledge of the P of the doping was not that they had an error within it. Okay. So also this dot of course will have an accurate of that, don't have a many error because it's just measures. Okay, so that's essentially a long list, but there are remaining challenges that Dimitri addressed yesterday, which is true. But it is not so much a one picture versus the other, okay? Because all of this data, all of this agreement, there is something to this phenomenological model. I mean, if you say another model, fine, no problem, make sure you get that right too. You see, that's my main point, you know. And you know, some of these models may be capturing some of these transports better than the optical ones, etc. And this is why I think the Michael's approach is going to be very enlightening as he continues with some, but like in the infrared as well. I think I wanted to talk to him later. That could be very interesting. But also, when comparing, you have to be a little careful of how you compare, because I wanted to remind you of some results that we obtain also as well. You've seen this, that of course the main thing that is the problem, which I think was Dimitri's was very right to point out, that this seems to have this blue shift. Okay? And one thing that I disagree a little more with, but that is not as, to me as important as this blue, this shift, that he sees a red shift and here we see a blue shift, is this aspect of the Drudat peak or not. These type of calculations do not capture any effects of disorder beyond the broadening or due to lifetimes, okay, to lifetimes of the block states. And these localization effects, which are necessarily going to be present in these highly disordered systems, are hard to capture, certainly in this analytical results. But they are not so difficult to capture within the same model in a finite exact analyzation type of model. And this was done essentially the same model, the KDAT-P model, But in a finite size, so essentially a periodic boundary conditions type of physics, where you put in the disorder, okay, an average of the disorder contributions. And there, in this case, you do not see, again, of course, this was for fairly low doping that we were doing at the time. That was 3 years ago, which is a lifetime ago to me. But again, you see this peak that you were mentioning. I think, well, he left, but anyway, I'll point out to him later that in the previous calculations, you see this peak going up. But in the next ones, you don't see the Drude peak is overwhelmed by this contribution of the peak around 220 MeV. And there, of course, you know, what is your Drude mass, or you know, how do you extract it? That's what I disagree, that you have to be a little more careful, and we need a few more than just one sample or two.
But you cannot get low masses, but get comparable to valence masses.
Yeah, so from that analysis. Well, but in this case, I wouldn't know how to get a mass out of this. I only know how to do the Epsom rule, for example.
There is no room for small mass in the data.
So that's the main message in there. Yeah. Huh?
What's the peak coming from here?
The peak is mostly from the interband transitions. If we actually put the two, you know, the minute that you don't have, this is still a six-band model, holes with impurity, with you know, disorder present in the system.
So, for example, if you were to do this kind of experiment on indium arsenide with a spin split, energy is pretty much the same as gallium arsenide, but the acceptor energy state is supported with this gallium arsenide.
Well, in that case, in this calculation, it would, because it's not capturing that bound. Well, I guess it is only capturing that bound state from the point of view that here you have this unit cell correction, and you do have the bound state of about 110 MeV. So here, this one is not telling you whether this is coming from the interband transitions. Or it may also be from.
You have defect states in there.
Yeah, I mean, this is the ones that, you know, with this bound impurity states there. I mean, you actually dope it. You put as many impurity, you know, cell correction, central cell correction defects in there as you have dopants. Okay, and then you calculate. So there, I'm not distinguishing between. Actually, that's more of your spirit, that they're both in there playing a role, and I cannot decouple the two.
Well, you can in the calculations by tracking the initial states.
Right, we didn't. Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yeah, it should be useful to go back now that we have a different way to understand it. Anyway, but again, this one, I cannot see. We also, see, you know, I cannot see a blue, a red shift in that sense. So. That as well, and it has this constant JPD, which may be a relevant thing. So that is important. So just the possible issues regarding infrared absorptions that we're trying to address in the future is this energy dependence of JPD, which I think is going to be important to find out. If the answer is negative, then we're, you know, keep thinking. Localization effects, which are captured somewhat by this earlier calculations that we may have to come back and do again. Okay, the fellow that did those calculations is not doing any of this physics anymore, so I'll have to find a graduate student to do so. A contribution due to other impurity states to the essentially what we discussed yesterday. That could be very important. But at the same time, emphasizing that this has to be kept in mind, that theory, it cannot be too totally different from the previous one. Okay, there's going to be a lot of equivalences. Maybe a one where you have different effective mass. I don't know how the Epsom rule would work in that case, but certainly it has to, right? But essentially, once you go to this other one, you know, as you said, there's no correspondence between this effective mass and the band gap. So I don't know. I'm just showing you my ignorance. And then the one thing that, although the as I said, the ball is in my court at the moment. I know we have to play a lot more balls because it would be nice, in terms of this effective mass, for the dopant that you were showing, you only have two at the moment, 2 points on this. The one that shows this peak, or this Ruta peak, and if we're able to do a few more, we certainly can give you a sample up the wazoo. But a little more systematic, it would be very helpful to indicate trends, essentially, intrinsic trends of the system. But keeping the score, just keep in mind that this effective model, so far, the message that I feel, we understand fairly well gallium manganese arsenide. There's some challenges that we need to understand that these may not be capturing. There must be some deep reason why. But all of these things have been very well explained by this methodology, these methods. But not only this is not just this method, all of these methods, because I showed you data of the interstitials of the, you know, this is a mosaic of theories, of approaches that have to give a coherent picture of GAM-NAS. But, you know, these are part of it. You cannot just ignore them. So I promised I would end up early, and I did. Any questions? Thank you for your time. I can go on to the next talk, but I don't think you want me to do that. I can give a private to anybody who wishes to know what's been all of it. Any more questions?
For this strain and assumption, do you use
a specific
model or
one of
the
KWP
model, yeah. No, the KWP is not necessarily specific.
Sorry?
It's not necessarily
specific. But you can introduce the strain very easily.
No, I'm asking whether you use the spherical model.
Spherical model. No, because it's fairly anisotropic, right? For that. So the strain, no. Not the spherical approximation, no.
Whether you can separate the
anisotropy in the spin state, or the other state. I'm not sure I understand the question. There we go.
Your score sheet seems at odds with the movie analogy, because as I remember, Clint Eastwood was the good and Lee Van Cleef was the ugly.
I was thinking, you know, as you noticed, there were three pictures, right, of my team members. I know who's the good. but I'm not going to venture to say who's the ugly. I have some pictures that I can show. Oh, and by the way, actually... let me not show you any embarrassing pictures farther, but let me introduce you to something that may find it, and I hope you spread the community. This review of modern physics, we try to do it fairly open. I mean, it's not my message, you know, Dimitri, when he points out this, you know, Hiro did this and somebody else did that. We're trying to do it through all the approaches. All the approaches are important here. You cannot just do K.P and say, that's it, you know. You cannot, you know, it is important to emphasize that all of them are giving you answers. You do have to be aware of the limitations of each of the approaches, okay, not to take all the physics at heart, some of them are going to capture it. But we put it in this website, you don't have to put this navigate something, you know, it's just a unix12.fcu.czechrepublic-ms for magnetic semiconductors. And in here you can go to the different, here you can navigate to the different things, and if you click here you can get your own little reference. As well as we're trying to keep, this is more of a favor to the community, a publication record of the different elements, of almost everything. Certainly anything that you put in Los Alamos archives. Sometimes experimentalists are not very kind and they just publish these things without putting them in Los Alamos archives. It's very hard to keep track down, and they expect us to read PRB by itself, which is not going to happen. But for example, at least it's not going to happen to me. But you can submit, and that allows you all the papers that are known and DMSs that I know of, at least. Then you can actually go say, well, if you're interested only on TC, you can zero that. So ferromagnetic critical temperature. You get only the ones talking about TC. You can also say, okay, well, what about a fellow? Let me see. If I just go Vasov, okay? what has he done lately?
She?
You haven't done much. No, just kidding.
Well, no, no.
Yeah. Anyway, you know, I hope you find this useful. Do tell your students that use that as a resource if you have a chance. But if you do, and you find it useful and use it, do let us know, because it's useful to report on that. I mean, we track of IP addresses, but you know, it's better that you let us know.
Together with the NSA.
Is the recording?
You shouldn't say that.
I am a star.
Thanks.